welcome to the Community Development Summit titled Organizing a Resilient Future, brought to you by the Permaculture Institute of North America, or PINA. If you support permaculture across the North American continent, then please consider becoming a PINA member today at PINA.in. I'm Jesse, and I will be your host for today's summit. Our next presenter is the tenacious Taryn Kirker. Taryn is an edible landscape designer, plant enthusiast, and co-founder and vice president of the New Start Community Garden in Burien. With over 40 years of experience in organic gardening in the Pacific Northwest, she brings a wealth of knowledge to her work in sustainable gardening. Taryn studied international development and linguistics in college, later earning additional degrees in nonprofit management, organizational communications, and teaching ESL. After a career as a landscape designer and a general contractor, she shifted her focus back to community food systems with the creation of the Shark Garden, a school garden and part of New Start's 1.6-acre garden park. Passionate about travel, food, languages, nature, and inspiring others to garden, Taryn shares hard-earned lessons and examples from her work in this informative and engaging presentation. Welcome, Taryn. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
As I was telling you before we hit record, I'm so excited by the Shark Garden. Just the idea of it is like, wait, what is that? I want to know. So I'm really looking forward to this presentation, as I'm sure everybody else is. Like, yeah. What is the Shark Garden? How do I have a Shark Garden? Do they garden sharks?
Maybe.
We'll find out. So the question I'm asking everybody, Taryn, up front before we begin your presentation is just like, most people tend to think of permaculture, especially if you're newish to permaculture, as relating really just to the landscape or to the garden. And indeed, we are talking a lot about gardens in the summit. But really, this is a community development sort of summit. And I wonder what you think of in terms of how permaculture can be used towards community development.
Yeah, that's part of why I thought I'd come today to talk to y'all, because we're an urban setting. And we're seeing this huge spike since the pandemic of interest in gardening. There was the first year of the pandemic, there was something like 18 million new gardeners in the United States.
Wow.
Because the food shelves were empty at the grocery store and people want to know about food and how to make it themselves,
yep.
Grow it themselves. And so a lot of people live in urban areas, and we feel that it's important to, you know, bring that knowledge to those spaces. And we're fortunate to have a space where we could do that, and just right outside of Seattle here in the burbs.
Awesome.
And some of the areas that really need this knowledge the most. So
that's great. So in a way, your garden, the landscape, is almost acting as a way to engage with the community.
Absolutely. That's our big mission, is to bring the, you know, sort of the local community into this knowledge and how they can apply it even on their balconies, honestly, and their patios. And then create a sort of community space where everybody can, you know, be included in learning about, you know, healthy food and stewarding the environment and all those other parts of permaculture that really involve people.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I love it. Without further ado, I'll let you jump into your presentation. I'll hide myself from the screen, but I'm here if you need me.
Okay.
Otherwise, take it away. And thanks again for being here, Tara.
Absolutely. Welcome, everybody, to the New Start Community Garden. We're also known as the Shark Garden. We're in Burien, Washington. So we're just on the edge of Seattle. We're in Zone 8B. I know I'm always curious on permaculture talks where people are coming from. So in this talk, I'm going to give you a little background about the garden, how we developed, and also how we used research to build sort of cultural relevance for our space, which could be really important in more urban settings for gardening, and how to create a multi-use garden space so that it's sustainable. And then how we build community buy-in and partnerships to support the garden and our programs as we go along. And like I said, we're in Burien. So we started out as a school garden, and the mascot for the school was a shark. So that's how the shark comes into play. We use this little guy here as our mascot for our social media, just to keep it engaging. We're also known as the New Start Community Garden when we added our Peach Patch program. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. So here's what the garden map looks like today. This is our 10th year of development. And we started as a school program for at-risk youth. We're right on a formerly used baseball field that we converted into a garden space. So it was an empty field that wasn't being used for a magnet high school that didn't have enough students to have sports teams. So we developed a summer program for them to work in the garden, get paid by the county, and get some math and science credit in the summers. A lot of the kids had court involvement, so it was actually the King County Courts Department that helped paid for them to be out there. They got paid minimum wage and got some credit, so that's how we started. And then over the next few years, we had the students start building out the garden using almost 100% recycled materials and things we found on Craigslist for free. So we'll see a few examples of that. We've continued that philosophy of being thrifty as possible to keep costs down. And the school district pays for our water for the garden. And otherwise, it's all been volunteer run ever since. And then a couple years later, we became a nonprofit. We added a pea patch program. And a few years ago, we started offering free gardening, cooking, and art and science classes for the public as well. And we use the original school garden, which is marked in blue here on the map, to grow food for our food bank partner now. And that's just with community volunteers.
Hey, Taryn, just to jump in real quick, can you explain a pea patch garden in case nobody's ever heard of that?
Yeah, sure. Pea patch program for us, we have 76 rental plots. Each plot's about 100 square feet. We have some that are raised beds for wheelchair access. And then the folks rent the plots for us for 1 year. And so we're the cheapest ones in Seattle, so it's only $25 a year, which is part of our philosophy to making it accessible. And a lot of the people who garden in these plots live in apartments or condos, which is common in an urban setting. They don't have access to land, but they'd still like to improve their own food security by growing their own food. So they do also do 10 hours of volunteer time during that year to help us take care of the common areas in the garden. That's how that works. We also were able to add solar. So we are off-grid solar, and we put in enough solar here on top of our tool shed, which was also donated, to be able to power an outdoor kitchen with it. So we can do kitchen appliances, we can do power tools for building construction, and it's a nice sort of community hub as well, because if the power goes out locally, we still have power, and community members could come charge their phones and things like that in case of emergency. So it's another way that we're kind of becoming a community hub for emergency uses. We also have built in over the years about 14 display gardens. The food bank garden, like I mentioned, is about a half acre. And then we have the rental plots, and the total space is about 1.6 acres. So it was a former baseball field and sort of track area that we took over. It wasn't being used, so we've taken it over. And then here is some examples of curriculum that we also developed. So on our website, we've developed free curriculum lessons that you can download for free, just educational sort of supplement things that people can access for their classrooms or just their families at any time. We've used grant money to help pay the instructors to develop this for you over the years. We also have, let's see, we're getting close to 40 different interpretive signs spread around the garden. These are some of our recent ones, including permaculture. So the students, one of the summer projects was to build a large tree guild. We've got an Asian pear in the middle of ours, for example. We've got nitrogen fixers, and they learned all about that and built us a display garden. And then we have a pollinator program too. So we have a couple signs about native bees and pollinators. We worked with a local photographer to take pictures, a bunch of the common ones. This is another way that we can continue educating in our space, even if I'm not there to give tours, for example. In 2024, last year, we actually offered 42 free classes in the garden. So we served nearly 600 people, over 1,500 hours of free education. We also had 12 other community events and gave 91 garden tours. So, very busy year. We grew over 1,300 pounds of organic produce for the food bank. That's just with community volunteers coming in. And we grow the things that are hard for the food bank to get. So more cultural crops, more ephemeral things that don't travel well. So that's another benefit of having the farm sort of in the community, as we're cutting down on the carbon footprint of the transportation and able to grow some more unusual but culturally appropriate things. And then in our pea patch program, about 90% of the gardeners there are from families of color or they're LGBTQ. So we've created a really inclusive space in the garden. So this is where we started out. It was just an empty field. It was honestly attracting garbage and crime when we started, and we hope to do something better with the space. So the school on the left side of the picture here. So that's where we started, and this is where we are now. It's a little bit blurry from Google Earth, but you can see we've developed pretty much the whole space. We've got one more display guard we're putting in this year, and then we'll pretty much be filled up. And we left a sort of open meadow area for community events as well. That'll be in the bottom left-hand corner. You can see we turned the old batting cage into a community stage. So we built a stage inside the cage. And then we show outdoor movies on there. We can pull food trucks up. We do Burien Art Market there. Lots of fun stuff. So that's a brief look at kind of the scale of what we're up to. So one of the things I wanted to talk about today was how to use, or how we used, some research to develop a community space that was really going to be relevant to the folks that we work with. We started as a school guard, so we talked with the school district, learned about the demographics for the students, first of all. But then we also used community demographics to see who was in our community around us, from census data to real estate data. City governments track a lot of these demographics. And there's also state level maps that you can use. We have one here in Washington that's the Environmental Health Disparities Map. So you could actually look at just, distribution of, where environment sort of really impacts communities more than other neighborhoods, where there might be a food desert and things like that. And those could be powerful tools to help you guide your program and, determine what's going to be relevant for your space. And then one of the first things we did is actually went around and visited 18 other school and community gardens in our area. And we interviewed them, we grilled them, okay, what works here, what doesn't work? Before we start, what do we need to know? And that gave us information like how far apart to put hose bibs, random things like that. How wide did the paths need to be? How many wheelbarrows do we need? So that was really cool. And then we also used a tool called Google Trends, which is really actually a fun thing I'll show you here in a minute, to help guide some of the development of the class based on what people are looking for on Google. It takes the Google search data and gives you sort of summaries of what people are interested in. And then we also got data from our partners like the food bank, and we work with the local tribal member as well to make sure that we were keeping them in mind for our local community and their land that we're using. The annual community surveys we put out also guide what topics we use for our classes. We start creating your own data and metrics as you go too, and those will help you, engage various topics, but also, guide where you're going. So I'll show you a couple examples of these here. So here's an example of the Washington State School Gardens. So there are organizations that keep track of these listings of where school gardens are. You can see a lot of them are obviously concentrated in the Pacific, in the Puget Sound area, rather. And that's one idea to give you sort of a look at what's already going on, and you could zoom in on these and get more information about where you might visit other examples. This is that Environmental Health Disparities Map. The little yellow arrow there shows where we are, and the darker the purple, the more environmental impacts and people have on their health. And that could be from urban pollution, all kinds of sound pollution. We're right near the airport, so we actually get funding from the Port of Seattle to offset the carbon footprint and the pollution from them. So it could be another interesting tool to see, when you zoom in on this, sort of what your status is compared to your surrounding communities. This is the Google Trends, which is really, oh, I'm sorry, this is the local demographic information from the census data. Sorry, Google Trends is next. So this gave us an information about the community right around the garden. So you can see most of the folks are age 64% were age 18 to 64, so sort of a middle-aged population. And then we looked at the race and ethnicity, as they call it here. 52% of our community is not white. And then we broke that down, so most of them are Asian or Hispanic in terms of those other cultural groups. And then within Asian, we looked further, and it's mostly Vietnamese families, immigrants. And so that gave us a little bit of, guidance of who might be visiting the garden and who we're sort of our audience would be. So this is what we did. We created a Latin American food garden, and we put it in Spanish as well on the sign so that we're sort of really thinking about what that data means for us. And then we also grew a bunch of Asian fruits. So we have Asian pears, we've got persimmons, mulberries, jujubes, intentionally growing things that are familiar to these cultures to help them feel included. And we also grow a lot of Asian vegetables for the food bank, for example. We also worked with a local tribe member to do a bunch of signs in our native plant garden, talking about the traditional sort of indigenous uses of our native plants. So we just had 20 of these signs made for our little native plant walk there that include the native name, native uses, edible parts, and then we teach a foraging class and we have indigenous storytelling classes and fun things like that, based on these signs that we have out there. Here's the Google Trends. So what Google Trends is it summarizes who's looking for what where on the internet using Google. So if you just type in a word like gardening, like I did here, it tells you what states gardening is the hot topic that day. But you could select your day range as well. So right now, Vermont is a hot spot for gardening searches. And it's funny because you could really break it down layer by layer. And on the day when I pulled this slide, the number one topic was World Naked Gardening Day, for example. There's a 120% increase in searches about that. The second most popular topic was guerrilla gardening. So it's really interesting to see what people were into. And if you look at the related queries here, gardening overalls for women and Birkenstocks and a gardening company near me, it gives you a lot of information about what people are thinking about, what they're wanting to learn. And we take some of this information. Well, like here's permaculture when I searched this morning, too. Top sort of related query is what the definition is. And again, Vermont is really a hot spot for permaculture questions this morning. And then agroforestry, peach plants are hot right now, it turns out. So maybe you do a social media post about growing peaches, to educate people, or a class on, stone fruit. So in response to that, we looked at what people were searching for during the pandemic. And the number one most searched gardening topic for the first 2 years of the pandemic was how to grow food in containers. So this goes to what I was talking about earlier, that people in the city don't have access to land, but they might have a little patio or a balcony. So we responded by building a patio display garden. And it shows all different types of containers that you could grow food in. And the different pots on here have different themes. So we've got one with native plants, we've got ones with herbs, we've got ones with fruits and berries. We teach classes now about container gardening and how to select like dwarf varieties of vegetables. They could grow in small spaces. We've since added some tower gardens on the patio here too, so you can grow vertically. We have little troughs that sit on the balcony railing that's next to this as well to show how to do that. And this is an example of how we responded to some of the data that we found. The other thing we do is every winter we put out a survey to all our followers. We post it on social media and to our, mailing list. And here's an example of some of the things they were interested in. And this question was, what kind of class topics are you interested in? You can see these were our three hot topics this year for classes. And so native plants and foraging, herbal, medicine is a big one, and then permaculture is right up there. People are really getting interested in sort of holistic ways to grow food and use their spaces, whether it's urban or, rural. So we found instructors for all these topics for our class lineup for this year. So here's some examples of, how to respond to all that data. We've got, you got to make sure you know what your mission is and your purpose of your garden space, and then try to rein in all this information to suit that mission. It can be exciting if somebody's interested in a topic that's really clear, like Birkenstocks on the trends, but we don't need a class in Birkenstocks. It's a little outside of our range. But we go out and find, chefs and instructors, partners to help teach the topics that we've identified through the research. And then we develop partnerships with them, like-minded organizations and experts. And we currently have over 20 partners now. And those are everything from other nonprofits to local chefs, to scientists and professors at the local universities come and teach for us. And our goal was to create a multi-use garden so that there's somebody there all year round, and lots of different interest groups are invested in using this space, and that makes it more sustainable and sort of our philosophy. We also use a lot of social media to share the mission and sort of invite people in. About 95% of our garden class visitors hear about us for the first time on social media, and increasingly by word of mouth, but it could be a powerful tool to really bring people into your project. And here's our Facebook and Instagram down there at the bottom if you want to follow along. Facebook, we're the Shark Garden, and Instagram, it's Shark Garden Burien. So the trick to creating a multi-use space, like I said, it can be a little tricky because we started as a school garden, and there's 45 school gardens in the greater Seattle area, for example. And those are tracked by organizations like Slow Food Seattle, the Department of Agriculture, our local county conservation district, and the Edible Schoolyard Project are all our organizations that track school gardens. But there's a problem with school gardens in that the main gardening season is when all the students are on break for the summer. And so most school gardens honestly fail unless there's somebody there all year to take care of them. And teachers and students rotate in and out too. So if you don't have a, identified leader or a really passionate person to keep it going, it could be really challenging to keep the gardens going, especially in summer. And a lot of them fail after a few years. So here's some of our students in our summer program picking service berries for one of our projects. Our solution to that was to bring in community volunteers for the summer season, and to use the school garden space to grow for the food bank. So we created a partnership with the local food bank. We asked them what kind of crops they were interested in growing, and they're just up the road, so we're hyper local. Saves a lot of carbon footprint as well as transportation costs for them. And we don't grow the big bulk foods like onions, potatoes that they can get in bulk, but we grow smaller, more ephemeral things like herbs and cultural crops. But we still do over 1,000 pounds a year just in our little school garden space. And it's a way for a lot of people to come and learn gardening without a whole lot of experience. They could come and join in, weekly to help out. And we have over 4,000 volunteer hours a year. And like I said, 91 garden tours that I led as well. But we also get volunteer groups coming in for work parties. We had 10 groups come last year. And we produced over 1,300 pounds in the food bank garden area. The other thing that we do is target interest groups. And that's a way to bring people into our space to attend our programs. And it's a good way to figure out, who's out there, who's interested in your content, and what content you might create for them. Not just in terms of social media content, but in the garden, like the interpretive signs, like the patio we created after figuring out what people were interested in. So here's some of the interest groups that we target on a regular basis in terms of what we're teaching. We found out that a lot of bird watchers are interested in our space. So we could reach out to the local Audubon Society and have one of their teachers come lead a bird walk in the garden. Plant geeks and master gardeners. So we include some plant geekery in our social media posts and on our signs. We do plant identification challenges on the social media sometimes. Bug enthusiasts and beekeepers. We've just recently, like in this photo here, added our own apiary. So we have a beekeeping program now in the evenings, and a pollinator program for people to work on our pollinator garden and native pollinators. And we've created an event this summer, which I'll talk about in a minute, that have related to pollinators as well. We have a lot of overlap with homesteaders and urban farmers, both rural and urban. And so we've created classes that are interesting to them. It goes to what you were saying, Jesse, about we think of permaculture as being more rural typically or larger spaces, but homesteading has been very trendy during the pandemic as well. People want to learn skills, improve their own food security. And so we teach classes on canning and food preservation, for example. We even have a guy come in and tell people how to raise chickens, things like that. So that's kind of a way that we've targeted those groups. Chefs, foodies, and cooks, we have really fun cooking classes, and we're able to get really high sort of power chefs involved because they are interested in our mission. But we've got chefs that have worked in Michelin star restaurants teaching us knife skills or random recipes, how to make your own dairy products or how to make your own pasta. And then we also work with local chefs from just different cultural groups that we saw in that data again. So we have classes on Vietnamese food, African food, Middle Eastern food, all these different things. We also attract bored senior citizens with projects. They've got more free time, so we try to recruit them for volunteers. Homeschool families come and do a lot of our activities and use our space to teach their kids. Engineers and carpenters help us with construction, landscapers and garden designers. We try to recruit them as skilled volunteers to work in our perennial beds. School groups, youth groups, church groups are all great volunteer sources. Corporate groups come in to do a work party for team building. We're getting more and more of them. And then other nonprofits that have similar overlapping missions, we try to sort of include them in our programming as well. There's some examples from this year. We've got classes in native plants and foraging, cooking classes. We're doing an iNaturalist bug bio blitz where it's a 3-hour event. Everybody comes, uses their iNaturalist on their phone and helps us get a snapshot of the biodiversity in the garden, specifically, as many bugs as we can document. For gardening, we've got the Washington Bonsai Swap Meet coming. We've got garden art classes for kids, construction projects for those seniors and carpenters, plant tours for the plant geeks, food preservation, orchard, livestock classes for those homesteaders. We got the pollinator program for the beekeepers and the food bank garden volunteer sessions for people just wanting to learn basic organic gardening. So those are some examples. For the bird watchers, we've got signs about bird watching. Here's birds of the Shark Garden. We've got art along our outside fences. We've got 80 pieces of laid by local artists and students. So people can do their own art walk at any time of year. We also build partnerships by inviting people to see us. Come do a tour with me. That's one of the ways that we kind of share our philosophy and our space and what we're doing. In this case, this was the De Denver Urban Gardens team came and the Beacon Food Forest team came for a tour with me. And we were obviously having a good time, so you should come and see me. I also reach out to local Facebook groups, like this is the West Seattle Urban Farmers Group, and it's got, 2,000 members just right next door to us. Just in creating a fig forest, we reached out to Fig Addiction Facebook group, and we were able to have 25 different varieties of figs donated to our fig forest. And they've got 26,000 members, so you could really extend your reach and your ask if you need support or donations from something into some of these online communities. For all those interest groups, you want to kind of explain your mission and what you're doing. You ask them for advice. People like to be asked for advice. You visit them, you provide value to them. So one of the ways we do that with other nonprofits is we invite them to just use our space for some of their programming. So a number of the nonprofits in Seattle have certification programs. So we partner with one called City Fruit that has a fruit tree stewardship certification program. And they come and use our orchard, for example. The Seattle Tilth organization comes and does a couple projects in our space for their certification program about soil stewardship, things like that. And then we do shared events. We invite them to table at our events. And you can also reach out to your city government. And they have grants sometimes that can help support this. And those partnerships also illustrate community buy-in for grantors if you're looking at grants. Here's an example of some of our partners that we've developed over the years here. You want to keep in mind you've got a purpose statement. And you do that when you seek out partnerships so that they kind of still fit in your purpose. This is our purpose statement here, similar to a mission statement. For nonprofits, but it helps for even just at a home scale level. What is the purpose of your garden to keep that in mind when you're developing, partnerships and friendships around your space? It can be really helpful to keep this in mind so you don't get distracted by all the other fun stuff going on out there. How do we pay for it all? That's one of like, boy, you're doing a lot. How do you pay for it? Most of our funds historically have come from grants and individual donations. Most of the grants have just dried up, unfortunately, so we're doing a little bit of hustle. But the grant topics that we apply for range from food systems to youth and art to environmental science, things like that. And we also get ones, like I mentioned, from the Port of Seattle to offset the carbon footprint for the airport and things like that. So environmental science oriented. We get some support from the school district because we're using their land and their water. Thousands of volunteers. Last year, the volunteer value was $151,000 plus. And we don't actually have an office or staff or even a phone. So it's just me who's paid when we have extra money running the place. And then we have a board of directors that help make big decisions. And then we've gone old school. We've got plant and bake sales about 3 times a year. And because we have such a huge collection of food plants, focus on edible landscaping. We're able to make all kinds of gourmet jams, jellies, pickles, herb salts, sauces. We have over 100 varieties of berries in the garden, over 50 varieties of fruit trees. I think there's over 60 herbs, and we make some really cool gourmet stuff that again attracts the foodies because we've identified them as a target group. And our restaurant and chef partners also help with that. And then we've got very cool board members that scour Craigslist in the free stuff section. And we've got so many things free off of there, and buy nothing groups and things like that. Our Kiwi Harvest sort of arbor used to be a wheelchair ramp. Our volunteer shed used to be a tree house that we took down and reassembled. We got it for free. Things like that. So it's good to be thrifty and keep your eye open and encourage people to do that for you too. We've got a number of followers now that will text me with a picture of something. Do you want this? It's at a yard sale. So it's great to communicate to your community that you're interested in that too. And so in summary, do your research about who might support you and talk to them about your purpose and your mission. Make the space attractive and visible to the interest groups that you believe are sort of related to your work. And you might help identify those interest groups with a tool like Google Trends, because it says related searches there. If you're looking up, permaculture or gardening, or you could look anywhere in the world in any time period, helps guide your decisions. And then find partners and volunteers who support the mission to sort of activate your space, get the word out there. We use social media, like I said, but it's a great way to sort of revive a community space like our garden. Since we started, we've had neighbors meet each other for the first time in the garden who've lived there for 20 years. But it's creating a safe sort of therapeutic green space that allows people to come together in a new way in some of these suburban areas where we find people are sort of scared of each other anymore. And it can be hard to get to know your neighbors without a space like this. To bring people together. So if you'd like to follow along, our website's shortgarden.org. We've got the resources page there. You could see our upcoming classes. I'd love for you all to come get a tour. And Facebook, Instagram, the email on the screen comes right to me because there's only me. So all the forms on the website as well come to me. So if you've got any questions or follow-up, you could just reach out. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you so much, Taryn. That was amazing. So many little pieces of information. One of the things I found that you did really well, and I don't know, maybe I haven't been thinking of it myself, is like that preliminary research stage that you all did. So thank you so much for that. Like if I
I
was
think it's
starting a new
critical.
community garden, that would exponentially make it more successful, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So
I think
good.
it's never too late to do that either.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. So that's a great tip. Talk to me a little bit about your I've worked in volunteer situations in permaculture, and sometimes I find myself burning out. So, do you have any advice since you're sort of the lead, you're giving all these tours and things, your stewardship
Yeah.
to this space is amazing. What do you do, or how would you advise folks to like not take on too much as a volunteer and like to avoid burnout?
Yeah, that's a real tricky one. For me, it's a passion project. It's my baby, right? And there's something sort of addictive about serving the community in, tangible ways. And we keep the metrics to show it. We've documented how many new pollinator species we have, how many pounds we've grown, how many community members have engaged with us. And so if you take a day off, you're not saving the world that day. It can be very hard to step away and slow down. But part of that too is building the community partners and the volunteer network to go and water when it's my day off, or to communicate your needs as well. If you need people to water, communicate that specifically and give them all the information they need. People may not be able to do full-on gardening for you. Maybe they're not physically able, or it doesn't fit in, but for watering, they could come after work on a, Friday or when and help out in a different way. So it's helped to break down those description of the tasks, I find, and share that out to, specific groups, and just let people know, be authentic, let them know if you're getting worn out or if you're tired. We always try to keep a sort of cheerful presence, a friendly presence. But I get tired, of course,
Course.
especially now in the spring where the weeds are growing like crazy. There's so many exciting things coming up. But yeah, it's good. It's all about communication, I think.
Yep, and
And
building that team, which you've done a great job. Talk
yeah.
about that volunteer hour. That the figure of just the how much money it would have cost is really impressive. How do you
Yeah.
organize volunteers if people are getting into this and they're like, "Oh my God, now there's 30 people here." Like, do you
Yeah.
have advice generally speaking about how to organize events?
That is a whole science in itself.
I'm sure.
Luckily, I came from working at Habitat for Humanity for a while as well, and we had, thousands of volunteers a year, and I worked with volunteers there, so I had some background in coordinating them. A lot of it, again, communication, setting up expectations, including like if things go sideways. In Seattle, we get weather, for example. Our group that's coming on Wednesday this week is probably going to get rained out or work in the rain. And so we have to communicate with them about that. And then, have resources for them to understand what the experience is going to be like. And then, yeah, don't overbook yourself.
Amen.
I can handle groups up to 20 usually, but then I'm sort of bouncing around and just, keeping them together in a smaller space so you can keep track of everybody and making sure everybody's, having a good time and feeling productive. And then it helps at the end of the volunteer session too to sort of stop and review what you've achieved. That's a good helpful tool. We always do a group picture in front of our little shark gate, like you saw at the beginning of the presentation. And that helps in a funny way bring people together as well. And
Totally.
then if it's corporate groups or things like that, we'll post that picture so they can share it. It makes them feel good about helping out the community. And we make sure you explain, the benefit of the work they're doing, what impact it's going to have. And then if I got a bigger group, I call in support, call in board members or more experienced volunteers to help out, guide the group
Perfect.
and adapt as well as you can.
Yeah, those are all great little points, great tidbits, lessons learned from doing it. You can tell you've been doing this 91 times last year alone. So one other thing, Taryn, that I had a question about, which was funding, especially with like the grant situation that's happening right now, which you mentioned. Do you every event, are you asking for like donations or doing like a suggested donation, or how do you approach that whole world?
Yeah, that's tricky because our philosophy is we want to provide the education for free.
Right.
So we put out a jar,
Okay.
honestly. In our reminder email for the classes, we mentioned there'll be a jar there, but we don't say more than that.
Okay.
People are encouraged, and we find that people, increasingly do it once they've been through one of our classes. They're high quality, classes with professors and really skilled people teaching. They get value out of it, and we sometimes I'll mention it at the end of the class. Like if you enjoyed today's class, there's a jar at the end of the table there. We'd really appreciate your support. But that's one of the things hard for me to ask for money. It's the uncomfortable part. But one of the things that you learn is that if people really buy into your mission and they like what you're doing, they're happy to support you. And so learning how that works is important.
Yeah, definitely. And I wonder too if y'all have had any thought or put into practice like having like memberships, you know, like a monthly $5 or something. Is that something that feels like maybe it would help with
Yeah, we're actually
getting
launching
folks?
that in a couple of weeks.
Or you are? Okay.
Yeah.
Because certainly some folks, I mean, I get it. Like when the mission is like, we want to provide all this great value, which you all are. You don't want to set a barrier. You can't set a barrier. It's against your mission. But on the other hand, some of the people who volunteer are probably like, I have $20 a month or a year or whatever, and I'd love to contribute. I love what you all are doing. So tell us about that new program. I mean, I know you haven't launched it yet, but what are you thinking? What are you hoping? What's the vision?
Well, we had a lot of discussions with the board about it. The real in an urban setting like this, $20 is a lunch. It's very expensive here. So our biggest discussion was what the donation levels would be for monthly giving. We ended up having $20 be the starting point and goes up from them for what we're calling subscriptions. If you subscribe to our mission and our philosophy, join us, as a monthly donor. But
Love
we
it.
have a regular donation page as well where people can donate one-time gifts and during classes or if there's special projects, we can, fundraise specifically for those. It's tricky in a low-income neighborhood like ours, but statistically, people of lower incomes actually give a higher percentage of their income than rich people do to charities.
Oh, go figure.
Yeah, so it's kind of a neat little piece of information. We just want
Yeah.
to make sure we're providing value and that they're benefiting from the space at the end of the day.
I
So,
love that. Okay, one more. This is just selfish Jesse question. We have an
yeah,
eight
go for
acre
it.
food forest that's a sort of a community project that we steward as a nonprofit as well. One thing we've never been good at is getting those beautiful signs that y'all made. Any advice for those of us who want to like make beautiful signs? Like, what have you
Oh,
learned?
yeah.
How do you go about that?
It's been really fun. Well, we've worked with a graphic designer, but really at the end of the day, all you need is a PDF.
Okay.
So if you can create a PDF even in Publisher or Canva, you just need a fairly high resolution PDF. We're increasingly using Canva to create things like that. Then you just take it to a local sign shop. They print it on vinyl. Ours have a graffiti coating as well.
Okay.
And then they're on a metal background, and then we just mount them on a 4x4 pressure treated post in the concrete, and we're
Okay.
good to go.
What's up with the metal background? You get that
That's
separately?
just to give it stiffness.
But that's not from the printer, right?
Yeah, they print the vinyl onto a metal sheet.
Oh, got it.
You can determine how thick that metal is. That changes the price.
I see.
So like a 18 by 24 sign, the printer cost is usually only $150,
Okay.
but the graphic designer could be $500, so
Sure.
it
Absolutely.
depends. So we take that metal sign, we mount it on a cutout same size of marine plywood, just so it's extra weatherproof up here in Seattle. Sometimes we'll paint the edges to seal it, and then we just screw it onto a 4x4 post, and you're good to go.
Yeah, makes sense. And those last pretty good in the garden over years and weather and all that, huh? Excellent. Well, that's beautiful. I don't want to take up more of your time. There's plenty of questions I would love to ask you. But really, you've provided an amazing model. And the goal of the summit, in some way, is to like see if other people anywhere in the North American continent or farther abroad who are like, oh, that gave me an idea to do that. And I'm right next to a school where a bit, like they might find this informative. And if that's the case, would you be open to people reaching out to you with like any questions or anything like that?
Of course, yeah, we find that there's, across the country, there's a lot of empty baseball fields.
No doubt.
One of the biggest tricks was getting the water situation sorted out. We had actually a Boy Scout troop come do an Eagle project to put in all our water lines in
Oh,
2 days.
nice.
And we had done the research how far apart we wanted the hose bibs at that point.
Yep.
And so there's lots of land out there and funny church backyards is another one where we see a lot of empty land. Things like that. There's space out there if
Absolutely.
there's a need that your community needs, or you're welcome to come join us, of course.
And what's your email again? It's info at
Info
sharkgarden.
at sharkgarden.org.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you for making that available, and hopefully you won't be overwhelmed by inquiries. You've mentioned the hose bib, so now I just want to know, what did you learn?
About 50 feet apart.
Okay, 50 feet apart. Okay, and that gets
That's
you
based
do.
on the average length of a hose that people feel comfortable carrying is a 50-foot hose. And if that reaches to the next one, you've got head-to-head coverage, so you're not having to reach all the way 50 feet out.
Right. Do you do just while we're on irrigation, do you do mostly hose irrigation, or do you overhead or drip, or do you kind of do a mix of everything?
We've got a mix of drip, and the pea patch folks use the hoses.
Okay.
So we're increasingly, as budget allows, adding, automated drip system to the food bank beds
Nice.
and like the berry patches, a couple areas, but there's a few spaces that we still hand water.
Yep. Okay, cool. Well, this was so wonderful, Taryn. Thank you so much. We greatly appreciate you being here again. And thanks,
Yeah, thank
everybody,
you
for
for having me.
watching. We appreciate you. We'll be in touch. Thanks again, Taryn. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
It's nice that PineNet is there to speak up and help network the permaculture movement. It's only capturing a fraction of the movement that are officially involved and are members. So, boy, if PineNet could get all the permacultures, or half of them, or a fourth of them, to all sign up and become working together, PineNet could just really do so much more.
Just every one of my 2,000 students, and all the students that have been through the course, wherever they are in the world, have in some way made a profound impact. And we could do much more if we could link them up and support them strategically. So that's why I'm asking for support from Congress.